It's another edition of Book Corner. Tony Basilio along with you. And the thing I love about doing this is, from my end, I bring you things that I love, things I'm passionate about, books that I read that I want to share with you. And I came across one recently by a gentleman by the name of Tom Doyle, who joins us all the way from UK, where he is currently a longstanding contributor and editor to Q, and his work appears in Mojo and some other places as well. Tom Doyle has a new book out called Man on the Run, as he documents Paul McCartney in the 1970s. And what you need to know about Mr. Doyle is that he has had tremendous access to Paul McCartney through the years, so he knows from whence he writes, and it is an excellent period piece. I was telling you, Tom, before, as I welcome you to Book Corner today, I was sharing with you before that the thing I love about folks like you who are great at what they do is that you put me right there. You put me right back in this period, which I would imagine was your intent as you started the project.
Absolutely, Tony. Yeah, I mean, it's great of you to say that, actually, because as a writer, it is something that I really, that's what I aspire to do, really, is to put the reader directly into the picture, not in a second-hand way, you know. So, I mean, this book opens with us on the farm up in Scotland with Paul and Linda. It's a tough time. The opening scene, really, is the Beatles have split up, but he can't tell anyone at this point, right? It's sort of the autumn of 1969. John Lennon has said, look, man, I want a divorce. And Paul has basically run away, as he put it to me, to hide away in the mists in Scotland. And he's having a really tough time, you know. I mean, it's almost like he's been made redundant from the best job in the world at the age of 27. And like you or me, I mean, everybody has rough periods in their life, and sometimes that involves taking to bed, drinking whiskey, not wanting to get up in the morning. And so this is really where we find Paul at the beginning of this book. And like you say, I really wanted the reader to feel almost, if it doesn't sound too ridiculous, as if they were sitting on the edge of the bed going through this thing with this guy. So that's great to hear that you feel as if the reader can be put into the picture a bit.
Yeah, and you hooked me from the very beginning, because the truth is, Tom, here's a guy who has the cat by the tail, so to speak, as we say in these parts. Here's a guy who's super rich, super famous, in front of the biggest band in the world. And in his mind, as you were able to pull out of them, he believed, in a sense, that it was over for him. And when you look through the lens of time, you think about all the great things he did in the 70s. I mean, he's the guy that had the most commercial success away from the Beatles, yet his belief was, hey, it's over for me. I'm washed up here. I'm in my late 20s.
Yeah, well, this is amazing, really, for us to think about now. But if you put yourself into Paul's mind at that point, I mean, everything that he had been involved with musically had been wrapped up in the Beatles. And obviously, you know, even though they'd had all these tough times, particularly after the death of Brian Epstein and stuff, they still were a gang. And obviously, they were the most famous gang on the planet, you know, more famous than the Stones even, right? So it's that thing that, I mean, if you look at 1969 in particular, at the beginning of this year, the Beatles get back together to do Let It Be. Now, obviously, it's a horrible time for them. None of them are really in the mood, blah, blah, blah. But Paul turns up at these sessions and he tries to rally them. He tries to get them energized and get them working again. And obviously, he does things like he annoys George Harrison, as we can see in this footage and stuff like that. And John Lennon is kind of on his own planet because of the drugs he was taking and stuff. But obviously, Paul is in there and he's been super energized, but also looks supremely confident. Now, you just fast forward to the autumn of that year where Man on the Run begins. And because the band is split up, it has absolutely knifed his confidence. And I think this is interesting because there is a quote from him where he says, if you've been an astronaut and you've been to the moon, what are you going to do with the rest of your life? And I really think that's where he felt he was at that point. It was like, this band, this amazing band that I've been in, have split up, right? And there is absolutely no roadmap for me for the future. And I suppose that's what I found interesting about Man on the Run, is you really are chasing this guy sometimes around the planet, right? And it's just like, what is he doing? Sometimes he's making brilliant records. Sometimes he's making baffling records. Sometimes he's making plain god-awful records like Mary Had a Little Lamb and stuff. And I think this is what is amazing about the whole idea of Paul in the 70s is that it was absolutely no given that he would get a career, even though he was seen as being the guy who'd written some of their best tunes, you know, the majority of their best tunes, you might argue. So that's it. He really was a man on the run. And that was my job, really, as an interviewer and as an author, was to chase him.
And I think it's really interesting because as you chased him, it's almost as if you're trying to tackle a greased pig. How do you pin this guy down? Is he a difficult guy? Because he's so guarded, right? With who he really is, he's really guarded, isn't he?
Yeah, totally, yeah. I mean, look, I was born in 1967. I mean, this guy was being interviewed before I was even on the planet. So this guy's got a few things to teach me about interviews. But having said that, what really happened was, basically, I decided to go in there from the second time that I interviewed him. Because the first time was fine. But as I talk about in the prologue of the book, it turned out that it was only 2 days before he announced his divorce from Heather Mill. So his head was somewhere else. He kept on looking at his watch. I thought to myself, well, this is entertaining, interviewing Paul McCartney and stuff like that. But I felt as if I wasn't truly engaging him. And so I decided the next time that I went into interviewing, which was 16 months later, to basically be really cheeky, to be a cheeky Scottish dude. And that's what I did. I went in there, and so I was saying, hey, man, they were busting you left, right, and centre in the 70s. You know, like an outlaw or something, weren't you? You know, and I was saying there must have been days when, you know, the police were sitting thinking, oh, we've got a slack day, boys. Let's bust Macca. And obviously, he started laughing with all this stuff because I think a lot of the time, particularly because of who he is, you just get this sense of reverence completely from interviewers. So, yeah, I mean, my job really was to get behind that sort of guard that he has. And I'm not saying that I completely succeeded all the time, but there were definitely, I mean, sometimes interviewing is like a boxing match, right? And there were definitely a few rounds that I won, and then there were a few where he got me on the ropes and stuff. So it is a bit like that. But, I mean, I knew that sometimes if I kept on pushing him with the same sort of line of inquiry, but just going around it in different ways and blah, 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 that I could get something that was new. And that's really what I feel did happen. And after I left that interview, his publicist turned around to me and said, oh, I think he enjoyed that. And so the next thing, I was back there in 10 days' time, and then I would find myself interviewing him maybe 2-3 times a year. As much as he's guarded and stuff, and there are certain things, it does not matter how much you ask him the same question in different ways. He ain't going to tell you because he's a smart dude and he doesn't want to reveal certain things about his past or the way that he worked. But having said that, because of the sort of way that I approached it with him, I do feel as if he enjoys it and really just knows kind of we're going to get the job done, but it'll also be fun.
Tom Doyle joining here on Book Corner. Man on the Run, which is a wonderful look at Paul McCartney in the 1970s, available from Ballantine Books. And believe you me, this is worth the time. If you're a fan of the Beatles, a fan of 70s music, a fan of just that time period and a period piece that this is, it is a wonderful look inside and a surprising look inside of a guy from the outside, Tom, who appears to have it all, and he's the one having commercial success. Yet you make the case that for Paul McCartney, the 70s are very much sort of almost a lost decade. He's trying to find himself.
Oh, absolutely, because, I mean, he had obviously defined certain things within the framework of the Beatles, and now really what he was trying to do was he was trying to carve out his own reputation as a songwriter. Because I said to him, even about, you know, the album Ram, I said, were you trying to do different things? He went, yeah, totally. He says, I wasn't trying to do things that sounded like the Beatles. He said, so I would do things that were more episodic, you know, so they're sort of songs within songs and all this sort of stuff. And obviously, the Beatles had done a bit of this, particularly with the collage of songs that makes up the second side of Abbey Road. But I think as you trace Paul's stuff throughout the 70s, I mean, he's very much influenced by what's going on as well. I mean, I was listening earlier today to Venus and Mars, right, from 1975, just basically because I was writing about it because it's coming out again. And this is very much, it was recorded in New Orleans, but it's very much an LA-sounding record. And you look at the way that he did certain things around that period, trying to get the other members of Wings to sing tracks on things like Wings at the Speed of Sound. And you can see that the influence really is there from sort of Fleetwood Mac and from the Eagles, you know, these multi-voiced bands. So, I mean, I think it is that thing that throughout the 70s, he was really trying to get his own sound together and also to escape the long shadow of the Beatles, which ties back to the title again, Man on the Run, because he really is trying to outrun this long shadow. Now, the thing is, my conclusion at the end of the book is that it was an impossible task, and he agreed, because obviously in his recent shows, he now plays lots of Beatles stuff. But I think this was it in the 70s. It was just this idea that he had to try and carve out his own thing.
I've always thought that it's interesting that he named his band Wings, simply because it seems to me he wasn't trying to run away from being a Beatle. He was almost trying to fly away from it. Almost like, in a sense, you know, almost...
Well, you know the story about this, actually. The story is the name Wings appeared. I mean, he had other ideas for band names. At one point, he wanted the band to be called Turpentine, which is not bad. And then he did also consider the Dazzlers, which is obviously pretty bad. Right? And basically what had happened was with the birth of Stella McCartney, there were complicated the birth. And Paul was really seriously worried for a minute there. You know, he was thinking that somebody was going to lose the kid or was going to lose his wife or whatever. So he said that he was in this sort of ante room at the hospital, sort of praying like mad. And suddenly this vision of angel's wings like appeared in his head. And this is where he thought, oh, there we go. Well, that's it. That's the band name, Wings. But yeah, I mean, look, man, they had their own plane as well during the 76 tour, which is a whole other story. And yeah, they were really flying away from the whole thing, you know. I talked to various guys in the band, and they swear, and Paul says, this did not happen. So it's one of these great sort of arguments that you have in the context of a book sometimes when you talk to different people. But they swear that when they were drunk and high, that they were taking turns flying that plane. And he says, no way would I allow that to happen with my family on board. But every one of them in the band swear that this was what was going on.
That's amazing stuff. As we visit today, Tom Doyle, Man on the Run, Paul McCartney in the 1970s from Ballantine Books. McCartney and Lennon had a real interesting relationship as the decade wore on. If they had a relationship at all early on, it was adversarial, and it played out publicly. The lyrics to How Do You Sleep that you pointed out, McCartney pretended in that decade as if it didn't cut him, but that had to hurt him, yes?
Oh, yeah, I think it hurt him massively. I mean, I think really that song, but also just the fact, I mean, he called it a strange turnaround to me. You know, he said it was a strange turnaround that we'd been the best of friends, and then suddenly, you know, we're publicly sniping at each other. Now, the thing is, in some way, Paul had kind of started this, right, at least in song, because there were certain little coded snipes at Lennon and Yoko on Ram, but they were really sort of pretty mild. But the problem with someone like Lennon, right, who obviously has this acidic tongue and is in a really sharp dude, is that if you poke a stick through that bear cage, right, that bear's going to take your arm off. And really, I think that's what happened with How Do You Sleep. And it was made all the worse by the fact that George Harrison was also playing guitar on it. So it was kind of like he was complicit. Well, he was complicit. And so I think it's a really tough thing for him to take that. And also, even though he looks like this supremely confident person, nobody's really like that, are they? So, I mean, with a former friend taking this really, really strong stab at you with this song, it was a precision attack. And yeah, I think it did really cut him.
Well, you know this. You're an artistic guy. You were telling me before you play music as well as cover it. I'm somebody who plays a lot of music myself. People I know who play or who are artistic, Tom, are sensitive people, despite the way they might try and hide it. We are sensitive people to the core. I can't imagine these two guys who are like brothers going at each other with album covers, which is another thing you pointed out. Paul, in a sense, being a little more innocuous with it. And Lennon, as you said before, he's Lennon. He's going to give it to you out loud. That's exactly, they even did it in album covers, didn't they?
Well, absolutely. I mean, that's the whole thing. I mean, I did ask Paul about this, but on the back cover of Ram, there is a picture, a nature picture of two beetles, two insect beetles, how would we say it? Copulating is probably a good word to put it, right? I mean, obviously, there are connotations, pretty obvious connotations to this. And he went, no, he says, I mean, honestly, that was not meant at all. And because I don't think he'd ever been asked about this before, I did believe him. he just said, it was just a really funny picture. So someone had came up with these nature pictures, you know, because that's kind of what the album was all about, right? And he said, and we just thought, look at that, that's hilarious, like, put that on there. But obviously, people thought this means whatever, you know, the Beatles are screwing each other, screwed by the Beatles, whatever, right? Now, when Ram comes out, obviously, Lennon puts out a margin with How Do You Sleep on it, and there's a postcard in there which sort of mirrors and apes, basically, what the cover of Ram was, which was obviously McCartney withhandling the horns of Ram. And the picture, right, that Lennon has in his postcard is him just holding the ears of a pig. And you just think, that is kind of, that's brutally funny, actually. But yet again, it must have been really cutting. But I'm a massive Lennon fan as well. And one of the things about writing this, because people assume that you completely, as a writer, come down on the side of Paul over John. And that's not true at all. I mean, I love Lennon. I've done lots of stuff. I mean, obviously, I was too young to interview John, but I've interviewed Yoko on numerous occasions, including in the Dakota, in their apartment in the Dakota. And you're sitting there in John Lennon's kitchen. She's talking about him and saying, look, it's like his DNA is still here. That's why I never left here. And so you feel very close to the guy there. But when you're talking to his widow in his kitchen, above the entrance where he was shot, it brings it so close to you. And she admitted in the interview that I did with her there that John was a really difficult man sometimes. And I suppose this is the thing. Musicians, as you say, Tony, are completely and utterly sensitive. Doesn't matter if they seem to be bombastic and full of themselves. Tiny little remarks can be really cutting to them. And I think when you're dealing with somebody like Lennon, who was absolutely brilliant at just cutting people down to size, you've got to expect that you're going to be in for flack. Actually, there's one point in the book where, basically, we all know in horrible detail what happened to John Lennon on the day or the days leading up to he was murdered. But really, I thought as a writer, we don't really know what happened to McCartney, right? So that chapter in the book, right, which is called The Wake-Up Call, that basically, it takes us through hour by hour everything that happened to Paul that day. But it also goes back through that year, through 1980, and how their relationship had kind of developed. And you know, they'd got to a point where they were getting on fine, they were talking on the phone. I mean, they'd had a rough 70s where they'd be falling out with each other, then they'd be best of pals again, then falling out with each other. And there was an American TV interview that Paul did live, and this was only something like 11 days before John died. And the interviewer said, look, John still seems to be out there making all these horrible remarks about you. How do you feel about that? And this is, I suppose, my point, is that Paul actually had to kind of draw his horns in, ultimately, when it came to John, because what he said in this interview was, look, he says, I'm really reluctant to say anything about John, because whatever I say, it seems to wind him up the wrong way. Paul just really seemed exasperated, and he said, what are you going to do with that? And so it's strange that right up till the end of John's life and their friendship, Paul really had to, as I say, draw his horns in, because he knew that if he took anything too far, that John would come back with 10 times the force.
Tom Doyle, Man on the Run is the book. So glad that he's taken a few for us today here on Book Corner. Again, this is available from Ballantine Books. Back to that whole dynamic between those two guys, two absolute geniuses. You paint a picture that really left me wanting more, and that's their final meeting, the final time these two guys met. It seemed like McCartney was really open to doing more with Lennon. Fill in the blanks there for me is in terms of what could have happened there if one guy would have been more willing to receive from the other.
Well, you know, I mean, that last meeting is really interesting, actually, because, I mean, it was just before Paul went on tour on the Wings Over America tour in 1976, and Lorne Michaels, the producer of Saturday Night Live, had famously gone on TV and said, look, there's been a lot of talk, right, about a Beatles reunion. I have got a check for $3,000, guys, right? Will you do it? Now, little beknown to him, John and Paul were actually sitting up watching the show in the Dakota in New York, right, which is only a number of blocks north of the studio. And they actually thought to themselves, hey, should we do it? Should we just go down there and do it? And then I suppose for whatever reason, it was probably late and they were stoned or something, and they thought to themselves, nah, let's not bother, you know? But I think this planted a seed particularly in Paul's mind. And he turned up a couple of days later with his guitar, and Lennon was in a completely different frame of mind and basically told him, you know, to do one, as they say in Liverpool, you know. So that was a horrible sort of end into the chance that this could have happened, because, again, as I say, with the Venus and Mars album that's coming out in a couple of months' time, this was really interesting, actually, because this was at the end of John Lennon's lost weekend, where he disappeared. He'd broken up with Yoko and he disappeared to LA with his girlfriend May Pang, and he hangs out with Harry Nilsson and Keith Moon and does a lot of drugs and, you know, a lot of drinking. Basically has like a second teenage year thing, you know, a blowout. But when he gets back to New York, he decides to pull it together, John, and he gets Walls and Bridges together, which is one of his greatest sort of post-Beatles records. But at the same time, or off the back of this, Paul is going down to New Orleans to begin work on what will become Venus and Mars, and he invites John down. Now, John, I mean, I talked to May Pang for the book, right, and John had come home one night to the apartment that he was sharing with May Pang and said, listen, I've been invited down to New Orleans to work with Paul, you know, how would you feel about that? And she's going, are you crazy? That would be amazing and stuff. Now, what did happen, I mean, and it's not to cast Yoko yet again as the witch or whatever, but this was the point at which John and Yoko were getting back together again. And whether it was nixed by Yoko or whether John had second thoughts or possibly just cold feet, that was never to happen. And I think that's a real shame, because it's one of those things. I think, you know, Paul said to me in the book, he says, look, at different times, one of us would get hot on the idea when the other was cold and all this sort of stuff. So I think they just didn't sort of meet and match at the right time for it to actually happen. If you think about like the 80s, it was the age of everybody sort of getting together, wasn't it? You know, making records together and stuff like that. And my prediction, really, if Lennon had lived, I think they definitely would have got together for Live Aid just to do a few numbers. Whether there would have been another Beatles album, I think is, I mean, there's every chance it could have happened, actually. I mean, you look at the fact that they got back together and, you know, finished off Lennon's Free as a Bird and stuff like that. So there's every chance in the 90s that, you know, that the Beatles might have tried to make another record. And this is talking directly to Paul. He says it was such a neat thing, the Beatles sort of catalogue. He said, what would be the point in going back and trying to add something to that, a coda or an addendum or, you know, as he put it, reheating a souffle, you know, it's never as good the second time round. So, I mean, I definitely think a Beatles reunion would have happened. But whether a new Beatles album would have happened, maybe would have been a bit tougher. Probably would have happened, though, wouldn't it? Surely. If they'd all lived to this time, then I'm sure there would have been another record.
I think what's so special about it is, in this day and age we live in, especially entertainment-wise, very seldom do folks like that say no to the money. And they said no to the money countless times. And that's what makes their story so special. You think about bands from over where you are across the pond. The Who, they never turned down the check. The Rolling Stones never turned down the check. The Beatles, though, for whatever reason, they had that money flashed in front of them, and they turned it down countless times. And then a second thought for you that I'd like you to just expound on here as we think about what a reunion could have been like in the 80s. You know, when I go back and listen to, and I'm a vinyl freak, when I go back and listen to albums that were made, produced in the 80s, they sound so dated. It would have been almost shameful for the Beatles to make a keyboard-induced record in the 80s against that backdrop with everything that was happening sonically in that decade, if those guys would have lived. Your thoughts on my thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I completely agree with you, actually. I mean, it's like, who would they have got to produce it? Who were the cool producers of the 80s? It would have been Don Was, or it would have been Thomas Dolby or someone. And I mean, right. That's not to put those producers down, but I mean, maybe to make a Beatles record, yeah. I mean, I don't know. It's one of those things. I mean, the 80s, yeah, were unkind, basically, to all those 60s artists. They all had a really rough time. I mean, you look at Dylan, all the crud he put out in the 80s. Lennon probably would have suffered from exactly the same fate, you know, because as much as we view Double Fantasy through sort of rose-tinted, poignant glasses and sentimentality and stuff like that, as a record, it's pretty polished, and it doesn't have the sort of bite of the early sort of post-Beatles Lennon records. So, yeah, I mean, that's why I suspect that they would have waited. Because that Beatles film, the Beatles anthology, I mean, that had been in their minds for years, you know, because they'd, obviously Apple had been collecting together footage and stuff like that. So that's why Free is a Bird and stuff like that happened. So you would like and hope to speculate that Jeff Lynne, who obviously understood what the Beatles are about, because basically just cribbed their entire sound, but then advanced it in some ways as well with ELO in the 70s. You would like to think that hopefully in the 90s that he would have been behind the boards, or probably they would have got George Martin, you know, even though he was worried about his hearing even at that point. But I think even for sentimentality's sake, they would have got George Martin in there. So I would imagine you might have got another Beatles album, say 96, 97.
I mean, that's just incredible to think about. Let's go back to some of the things that you wrote about as you visit with Tom Doyle. And Tom, do you still have time here? Can we continue to do this? Are you okay?
Yeah, that's fine. Go for
okay,
it, man.
Yeah, because you're really excellent today. And so if we can go a little while longer, just a couple other things I wanted to touch on about the book. Some great stories in the book. Some things that really blew my mind. Some things that had me scratching my head going, what in the world was McCartney thinking? First of all, when it was time to record Band on the Run, they go to Africa. And there's a flare-up there with one of the locals. They're actually feeling threatened by the presence of Paul McCartney. Expound if you can.
Yeah, it was one of those things. I mean, I think the idea of going to Nigeria was, I mean, you've got to remember that, you know, since 66, when the Beatles stopped touring, they were basically stuck in the studio, mostly Abbey Road. And in the 70s, the whole idea of location recording came into vogue. You had like Led Zeppelin with, you know, the Rolling Stones mobile, driving it around the English countryside and recording drums in caves and stuff like that. So I think it was one of those things that McCartney thought, hey, you know, we can go to Nigeria, we can sort of have a holiday and, you know, hang out on the beach and do a bit of recording. Well, it wasn't to work out that way, you know, because this kind of shows you the sort of current theme in the book, which is Paul's sort of gentle eccentricity. And this really shows you, you know, because he travels with his family to Nigeria, which was a country that had been riven by civil war only a few years beforehand. So, I mean, it's still a really dodgy country, right? And there are open sewers. On the way to the airport, Denny Lane sees this guy getting knocked over on his scooter and killed, right? And nobody even stops. So it is one of these things that, I mean, they had basically airlifted themselves into a completely alien landscape. They get to the studio is completely unfinished, half the gear's missing, so they have to help to rebuild the studio before they do anything. Then, I mean, it's a complete catalogue of disasters. Paul and Linda are walking around one night and get mugged at knife point by these guys who jump out this car, and they steal, like, his camera, but they also steal his cassettes, which basically have all the songs on them. So he has to relearn the songs, and all this is going on. But as it turns out, obviously, as we know, Band on the Run turns out to be one of the most polished records that he made in the 70s. But the problem, main problem, really, was Fela Kuti, who, an amazing musician, but he was sort of the self-styled prince of Nigeria. And, you know, he had a complete sort of harem of wives and all this sort of stuff, and was just stoned off his nut all the time. But amazing things. I mean, McCartney goes to see a show by Fela Kuti on the outskirts of Lagos, and as he put it to me, got overly stoned himself and had a massive attack of, as he put it, the heebie-jeebies. And so he was just, you know, basically the band members started sitting down at his table kind of trying to ask him questions. Why are you here though, man? You know? And like heavy in him and stuff like that. And so he escapes basically with his life, even though he had an unbelievably paranoid incident there. But then the next thing is Fela Kuti goes on the radio in Lagos in Nigeria and basically accuses McCartney, right, of being in Nigeria to steal African sounds for his latest album. Now, as we know, because we know Band on the Run, I mean, apart from the odd conga part, there's nothing African about it, you know. I mean, it could have been recorded in Abbey Road, basically, and not in these trying circumstances. So this sort of summit between McCartney and between Fela Kuti was kind of hastily arranged, where Kuti turns up, right, with these heavy bodyguards and stuff like that, and obviously there's a heavy atmosphere again. And McCartney has to play him through some of these tracks and go, look, hey, man, we're not stealing your music. I mean, blah, blah, blah. So completely satisfied by this, Kuti leaves. But, you know, it's one of those things that actually Denny Lane pointed out to me, that really Ginger Baker, who lived out in Nigeria as well and was big friends with Fela Kuti, they kind of traded a bit off that sort of notoriety. It's like, hey, we faced up a Beatle when he was in Nigeria and stuff. It brought attention to Fela Kuti as well. So a smart man. He obviously played McCartney in a way, but then ultimately didn't play McCartney because McCartney managed to say to him, look, man, there's no way we're stealing anything from you here. But it was good publicity for Fela Kuti.
Oh, there's no question. And it also makes you kind of wonder, but again, we go back to this. These guys are not like the rest of us. They're idealistic. Hey, I can go there. We can have an impact. We can record this record. Who in their right mind, as you were saying, is going to take their wife and their band, I guess they would have had young children at the time, into a situation like that? But you and I would look at it and we would say, that's, as you would say, that's mad, man. You can't do that.
Well, I mean, I admire that spirit in people like McCartney, really. You know, just the fact that it's like, hey, let's just go and do it. Having said that, there was a letter. I mean, the end of that chapter, not to spoil it for your readers who hopefully will read this.
Yes.
But the end of that chapter is interesting because after this really heavy episode, he gets back to London and there's a letter from somebody high up in EMI, I think it's the chairman or whatever, says, dear Paul, we'd strongly advise against you going to Nigeria because there's been an outbreak of cholera there. So if this letter had arrived right before McCartney had left, he would never have gone. There's absolutely no way he would have gone. So even though he seems like this freewheeling sort of adventurous spirit, which he obviously was on some levels, I think something like that, taking your kids into a country, you know, where they could, you know, leave with cholera, well, is one of those things that you would maybe make you think twice, no matter how adventurous you are.
Let me say this for the sake of this book, as Tom Doyle's with us here on Book Corner, Man on the Run. If you're a Beatles fan, a fan of 70s music, as I was saying before, or just somebody that likes a great story, this guy's life and Tom's ability to peel back the onion and get McCartney to open up and folks around McCartney to talk about some of the things that were going on, including members of Wings. Tom, I've got to tell you, McCartney didn't exactly come off as a wonderful guy. I'm not really sure in retrospect what the purpose of Wings was, if he was trying to fill a space there by having a band around him, but he looked pretty cheap with the way that those guys were treated. McCartney was pretty chintzy with those guys.
It's one of those things. It's a northern working class thing as well, where you keep your hand on your wallet, you know. And I think, yeah, I mean, it's a strange thing, isn't it? I mean, I suppose you've got to remember, when Wings were formed, because of the Beatles court case and stuff like that, and the dispute over the partnership, I mean, all of Paul's money, or a lot of Paul's money, was tied up. Now, I suppose it's one of those things. I mean, you ask, why did he put the band together? I mean, he thought about putting a super group together, but then that's not the organic way that the Beatles came together. So he's trying to do this. He's trying to put a band together from square one. But yeah, I mean, it can be argued, really, that, I mean, he was putting these guys on cheap session rates, you know, like cheap retainers, basically, where it's like, you know, they were getting lots more money, you know, like Denny Sywell was getting a lot more money for playing on sessions in New York and stuff like that. I think there might have been a sort of element of, hey, you're playing with a Beatle, man. I mean, think what this is going to do for your career and stuff like that as well. But yeah, I mean, it seems to be a recurrent, absolutely, you know, that musicians moan about how the financial dealings were done on a sort of hippie handshake and there were never contracts. And then sometimes when there was the sort of talk of contracts and stuff like that, then sometimes the musicians would say, suddenly I don't want to get tied up into this. And it's all that's a bit murky, actually. I mean, the one thing that McCartney does say when it comes to Denny Lane was, he said, look, he got $1 million, I think it was £1 million, actually, right, over the course of the 70s. And he says, you tell me what other musician who was playing in a band like that, you know, and not writing all the material, made that amount of money. Now, you can argue whether that's right or wrong, but definitely all of those musicians, I mean, there was one of them, the guitarist, Henry McCulloch, he was laughing and saying that he was as tight as two coats of paint, which is pretty funny, you know. But, I mean, McCartney's made light of his stinginess and stuff like that. I think, I mean, look, I'm Scottish, man, right? I mean, I'm not a stingy guy. But I can understand, coming from that working class thing of haven't had anything, that as soon as you get money, you're very careful with it. And I think really that's where McCartney was coming from, because you've got to remember, the Beatles really kind of got ripped off, actually. And
yep,
there's a point at which McCartney's built his solo career up, right, and he's worth $25 million. And Lennon turns round, so this is 75, 76, Lennon turns round to Yoko and says, how come I'm not worth that amount of money? So you've got to think about the fact that John Lennon, right, in 1976 was basically jealous of the fact that Paul had made 25 million. Now, I mean, British bands who haven't even had a number one album in the States or whatever are worth far more than that now. So it can definitely be levelled at McCartney that he should have maybe thought about giving them more money to keep them in the frame. But I suppose you've got to take all these different things into context as well.
Again, congratulations on the book, Man on the Run from Ballantine Books. I want to give you the final word here. Maybe introduce something we haven't, or tie this together for me, Tom. You're a writer. You do this for a living. Lay it on me. Have the final word. Go ahead.
For me, it was a complete labor of love to write this book because a very different Paul McCartney was emerging in my eyes when I was interviewing him. He was often seen as being the sort of big-eyed, balladeer, sort of soft Beatle or whatever. Whereas actually, in my eyes, he was quite a rebel in the 70s. The world's best-known pot smoker, Rolling Stone called him at that point. And he was being busted left, right and centre and really did not care. And also, so that was one element that I found fascinating about the book. But the other thing that I found fascinating about writing the book was that he just did not know where he was headed. And that's the whole thing. We know, as Beatles fans, right, how this story played out. But if the reader can read it, imagining it from his perspective of not knowing what's around the corner, then, you know, hopefully they'll find that Man on the Run is quite a thrilling chase.
Couldn't agree more with you. That's why I couldn't put it down. And I knew how it ended. But yet, Tom, you put me right in the middle of it. And for that, I say congratulations to you once again. And hopefully, folks listening will pick up Man on the Run from Ballantine Books. Tom Doyle, thank you once again for joining.
Thank you very much for having me on the show, Tony.
And this concludes today's Book Corner. Back to what you're doing here on the app at TonyBasilio.com. Thank you for listening. Hey, Tom.